This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Kinnairy. Later this hour, as the rains come down, giving our trees a much-needed drink of water, we'll learn more about proper tree pruning in advance of rainy season and about the state of our trees post-Irma on the precipice of the 2018 hurricane season. But first, did you know that Florida, or what was called East Florida by the British at the time because it was one of their colonies, played a big role in the Revolutionary War? Believe it or not, it did, and today we're going to get a history lesson to find out more. This idea came across our desk recently when our guest, Dr. Robert Smith, was in Southwest Florida to present a lecture on his book, The 14th Colony, The American Revolution's Best Kept Secret. We were not able to catch up with him while he was in town, but thought it would be interesting to pick his brain about this overlooked part of Florida history. So he joins us now from St. Augustine, which plays a central role in this story. Dr. Smith, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing great. And just real quick, I understand you got some peacocks around you.
Yes, I do. I'm at the beautiful Fountain of Youth Archaeological Park, and there's about 48 peacocks out here.
Okay, I just wanted to mention that in case we hear some weird squawking in the background, our listeners will not be confused.
It's hoarding season. Yes.
Okay, so we are talking about the role Florida played in the Revolutionary War. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So first of all, I just want to ask you, Dr. Smith, you live in St. Augustine. How long have you lived there, and did its deep history play a role in you choosing to live there?
Oh, absolutely. I was 9 years old, 8 years old, when St. Augustine was on the cover of National Geographic magazine for the 400th anniversary, and I thought, you know, if that's the oldest place in America, then that's where I want to live. And I was living in Oklahoma at the time. But I've lived here for about 6 years now, researched and studied here while I was at the University of Florida, and have been in love with the city for most of my life.
Gotcha. Okay, well, and let's start with the basics of this story. When and how did Florida become a British colony?
Well, in 1762, the Spanish thought they'd be real clever and jump in at the end of what we call the French and Indian War and see how much free stuff they could grab, basically. And the first thing that happened was the British captured Havana, which was Spain's most crucial port in the Caribbean. The second thing, the Spanish realized that they had jumped in on the losing side, and they came to the Treaty of Paris in 1763 basically saying, we'll do anything to get Havana back. And the British response was, well, you haven't done anything with Florida for the last 250 years, so how about we take that? And they did, and Florida at the time consisted of the peninsula that we know now today. And if you draw a line from across the top of our panhandle all the way to the Mississippi River, that was Spanish Florida. And the first thing the British did was they divided it into two, so that you had the capital of West Florida at Pensacola and the capital of East Florida at St. Augustine. And then in 1764, they increased the northern boundaries significantly to make it a much larger colony.
So paint for us a picture of the scope of British territories when the Revolutionary War first started, when the first shots were fired at Lexington and Concord.
Well, that's the interesting thing. We think of 13 colonies from New Hampshire down to Georgia. When you look at the war from a British perspective, they had to concern themselves with 33 colonies from Nova Scotia down to Grenada. And 16, or approximately half of those colonies, were in the British West Indies. So when historians refer to East Florida as being on the periphery, on the edge of everything, so far down it didn't matter. I've read them, referred to as the hinterlands, the shadowlands, the Disneylands. I mean, it's just whatever was down there and didn't matter, kind of a thing. But when you measure the distance between the capital of Nova Scotia and the capital of Grenada, the geographic center of the British Americas in 1775 was just barely north of the St. John's River in present-day Jacksonville. So St. Augustine was actually at the epicenter of the British Americas when the Revolution broke out.
So remind our listeners how important sugar was to the world and the economy at this point in time, because it's going to become a key ingredient in the importance of Florida in this story, right?
Yes, absolutely, because I mean, for the first time, sugar was not, baked goods were not only sweet and tasted great, coffee tasted good, tea tasted good, everything tasted better, and now it was, because of the way they were harvesting it in the Caribbean, it was now more accessible to more people, and sugar became the global economic equivalent of crude oil today. Sugar afforded empire, so much so that when the British referred to as the Meer Rebellion in North America broke out, they had two priorities. Number one, don't lose.
We appear to have lost Dr. Robert Smith. We will work to get him back on the line. He is the author of the book, The 14th Colony, The American Revolution's Best Kept Secret. It talks about the story of the role the British colony called East Florida played in the war. Is this history familiar with you, or is it new to you like it was to me and the rest of us here at the WGCU newsroom before reading his book? To ask Dr. Smith a question or make a comment, give us a call now. The number's 877-428-8255. That is 877-GCU-TALK. You can always ask a question on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media or on Twitter. We are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Dr. Smith, we're back. So pick up your story about sugar. Sorry about that.
No. I'm sorry to you all. Basically, like you say, the British had two priorities when the revolution broke out. Don't lose a square inch of soil to the Spanish or Dutch or French in the Caribbean. And priority number two was reclaim the American South, because by September of 1775, every British colony south of the Chesapeake Bay, with the exception of East and West Florida, had fallen to the rebellion. And those were the colonies that produced the flax for clothing and the foodstuffs that fed and clothed the slave population that produced the sugar. So they needed these colonies back.
Yeah, and it's interesting. They needed them because they produced what was needed in the East or the West Indies, so the sugar could be produced. It was kind of a mutual dependence.
Yeah, I've even read where they referred to East and West Florida as the warehouses of the Caribbean. Hmm. Not East and West Florida, I'm sorry, but the southern colonies.
So what was happening in East and West Florida between 1763 and before the, you know, until the war started?
Not a lot. Matter of fact, if you look at the records from 1763 to 1774, East Florida didn't make a dime. It was you had all of these people coming in, being granted 5, 10, 20,000 acre plantations. And the idea was that the second and third born sons were going to have an opportunity to come in and get large agricultural opportunities, just like their brothers did down in the Caribbean, because the laws at this time, everything went to the oldest son when the father died. So these were opportunities for second and third born sons to make their fortune. But it didn't pan out primarily because in East Florida, the Seminole were awesome. They were bad, and all they basically had to do was stick their heads across the St. John's River, yell boo, and everybody ran to St. Augustine to hide in the Castillo for a week at a time. And it just got to the point where nothing was being produced down here, and I'm being you know kind of off the cuff about it, but it came down to there was nothing was happening until 1774 when Governor Patrick Tonan arrived and established the colony economically, and which is interesting because he was brought here for military purposes, because they knew about all the rebellion brewing to the north, and they put a man here in the governorship of East Florida that owned 20,000 acres plantation, so he had a stake here, and he was 33 years a British dragoon, and was the kind of person that had a tremendous chip on his shoulder. He'd fight at the drop of a hat, and sometimes I think he'd drop a hat just to see what happened.
And in your book, you talk about how impressed he was with the fort when he showed up in St. Augustine. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, the fort here it was built, construction started in 1672. It was completed in 1695. The Castillo de San Marcos here in St. Augustine never fell to an invading army. It's a siege fort. It was designed to withstand the sieges of 8 to 9 months. It was absolutely a bastion. And so to inherit something like this already set and ready to go was unbelievable for Tonon. And not to mention, with Fort Matanzas down at the other end of the Matanzas Inlet, it gave St. Augustine the only pair of stone fortresses south of the Chesapeake Bay. So not only did the Florida serve as a barrier politically to sedition and rebellion rolling out into the Caribbean, but it gave the British military launching pads, if you will, for going into the southern colonies and reclaiming the South.
How did, you know, the fort had been there for a long time. How did it fare against sort of the what was modern warfare at the time, cannonballs and whatnot?
The fort is made of coquina. And so rather than being a solid rock matter, coquina is actually made from millions and millions of tiny seashells. And what happens is when something like that, a cannonball or something, strikes the fort, it absorbs the shock, the kinetic energy of the cannonball. So it was more likely, instead of breaking a wall to pieces or something like that, battering it down, that the cannonballs would bounce off. And in some instances, not as often as people here in town like to claim, but every now and then one would stick in the wall. And we've got the pockmarks to prove it.
So once the war broke out, how did the residents of East and, I guess, and West, but primarily East for this discussion, how did they respond? I mean, were they all loyal to the British? Was there some some disagreement amongst the population? How did they respond?
Well, East Florida was adamantly loyal. West Florida as well. But in East Florida, they were, again, they had not made a dime until 1774, and then in 1775 they made a lot more money. In 1776 it was looking great, and then on August 11th of 1776, news of the Declaration reached St. Augustine, and basically the people go, wait a minute, we just started making some money, and you want us to do what? And so a large group of people met in the plaza here in St. Augustine with effigies of John Hancock and Samuel Adams, and strung them up in the trees and set them on fire. This was not a place where a third of the population was loyal and a third was for rebellion and a third just wanted to be left alone. This was a place where everybody was for king and country.
How did the other southern colonies respond, you know, just to the north?
They had a lot of problems with this because, you know, we've always heard that the whole reason Washington invaded Canada was because he just couldn't stand the idea of having a British entity to his north. Well, he felt the same way about the South. And matter of fact, in December 18th, 1775, from Cambridge, Massachusetts, when Washington is two-thirds of the way through a year-long siege of Boston, he has an army invading Canada simultaneously. And on December 18, 1775, he writes the first of 81 letters that I've found so far, citing St. Augustine as a military concern, and he asked Congress for an invasion, an army, into East Florida. And they literally saw what was going on down here as so problematic that they opened a third front as far away from everything else as you can possibly get. And you don't have to be a military genius to understand that the third fronts don't work that often, if ever, kind of a thing. But that's how important they saw what was going on down here.
We'll get to those invasions to the south in a little bit, but there was, talk about the Southern Expedition. It was an offensive from the south to the north, which is the south, however you put it.
Yeah. No, I found a letter dated December 6, 1775. It was written by Lord George Germain. He was the Secretary of State of the American Colonies, and he's basically the guy running the war. And what the British designed to do was to have a large invasion fleet come down from New York with General Clinton, another fleet come over from Ireland with Cornwallis on leading that expedition. There was the deposed governor of North Carolina, Josiah Martin. He claimed to have the names of 10,000 loyalists who were ready to die for king and country. They were just They were just barely, you know, they were poorly armed. And so Cornwallis brought 10,000 stands of arms with him. And they were all going to rendezvous at the Cape Fear River and then proceed towards Savannah. And in the meantime, General Prevost was to come up out of St. Augustine with 2,000 British regulars. And Thomas Brown was to head over from Pensacola with 4,000 backcountry loyalist woodsmen and 2,000 Creek warriors. They were going to hit Augusta and then come down the river, and everybody was going to converge on Savannah.
And how'd that go?
It went poorly. the first thing that happened was loyalists coming down from North Carolina. There weren't 10,000 of them. There were about 1,500, and they weren't poorly armed. They were barely armed, and they ran into 1,000 heavily armed American militia there at Moore's Creek Bridge, and were just soundly defeated. They really were never significant in the war again after that. Clinton shows up to the Cape Fear, but then so does John Stewart, the superintendent of the Southern Indian District. And originally he had said, yes, I've got 2,000 Creek warriors that I'm going to throw into this fight. And he showed up to say, yeah, they're not coming. I've completely changed my mind, and they're so not coming that I've called a Congress in Pensacola, and they're going the wrong way. And then in the meantime, Cornwallis had been blown out to sea by a hurricane. He didn't show up until May 3rd. So Prevost comes up out of St. Augustine with his 2,000 British regulars, and the army that Washington called for in that letter of December 18, 1775, were waiting for him. And they had made their way down to the St. Mary's and St. John's River. And when Prevost saw what was going on, he turned around and headed straight back to St. Augustine to shore up the defenses. And Thomas Brown was left wandering around out in West Florida and Western Georgia, looking for his 2,000 Creek warriors that weren't coming, and his 4,000 British loyalists. They kind of looked around and said, you know, these Creek are pretty savvy. If they're not coming, maybe we ought to just wait and see what goes on. So they didn't show up. And it was so poorly orchestrated that it completely fell apart. The only thing that we recognize of the thing is we have memories of the Battle of Moore's Creek Bridge and the British defeat there. And then once Clinton and Cornwallis got together at the Cape Fear, they said, well, let's go ahead and take Charleston. I mean, they're just colonists. How bad can it be, right? And so they sail into Charleston in the summer of 1776 and get soundly defeated and sent back to New York. So, but it shows the British intentions,
right?
That early in the war, you know, in the fall of 1775, they're calling for an invasion into the southern colonies to reclaim the entire South.
I am joined today by Dr. Robert Smith. He's author of the book, The 14th Colony, The American Revolution.
Roger.
The American Revolution's Best Kept Secret. It tells the story of the role the British colony called East Florida played in the war. Is this history familiar to you, or is it new to you like it was to me before reading this book? Ask a question or make a comment by calling 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. So how many times did revolutionary forces attack the fort or invade south into East Florida?
They never got to the fort.
Okay.
The first time in 1776 they came across the combination of Continental Army regiments from North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, and then militia army from Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, and Georgia were making their way down to the border of East Florida and Georgia, which is the St. Mary's River. The Georgia militia got there first and got bored, and Georgians being Georgians, they picked a fight with the East Floridians, and before you know what's going on, they had completely captured the wedge of land in East Florida between the St. Mary's River and the St. John's. And for those of you who are listening who are not familiar with Florida, St. John's is the river that runs right through the city of Jacksonville. They held that land. By the time the rest of the army, the main body of the army, reached the St. Mary's River, they were so riddled with camp fevers, they were losing 14 to 15 men a day. And they couldn't have crossed that river if they wanted to, but the British didn't know that. So so basically what they were laying up there unable to move, and the British sent spies into the Georgia camps there at the St. John's River, told them that, they were their homes and families are under attack by 2,000 Cherokee warriors. You know, you need to go home, and they did. In 1777, Washington asked Congress a second time for an invasion into East Florida. It was authorized, and armies invaded at and were defeated by the British at the Battle of Thomas Creek, which is the southernmost battle of the American Revolution, the southernmost land battle. In the spring of 78, Washington called for an invasion a third time. And this army was defeated in the town of Callahan, Florida, up near the Georgia border, and at Alligator Creek. And then in the fall of 78, Washington asked Congress a fourth time for an invasion. They approved, but then General Rochambeau talked Washington out of it. He said, "Our intelligence tells us that the British are moving on Savannah from New York and St. Augustine. Let's pull back and protect Savannah, and we'll save East Florida for later." Well, that's what we did, and we lost. And then a fifth time, in December of 79, going into January of 1780, Washington asked Congress for an invasion into East Florida. And again, General Rochambeau interceded and said that the British are now going to be moving from Savannah into Charleston. Let's pull back, protect Charleston. We did, and we ended up losing anyway.
Huh. Tell us about, is it Fort Mose? Is that how you pronounce it?
Fort Mose.
Mose. Tell us about Fort Mose, because it was something I'd never heard of, and it sounds like it has an interesting bit of history.
It does. It does. In 1793, the Spanish government there in Madrid decreed that any English slave who ran away from Georgia, or not Georgia yet, but the Carolinas and Virginia, anyone who could make it down to Spanish Florida and declare loyalty to the King of Spain, convert to Catholicism, and join the militia could be completely free. So this became such a problem that in 1733, to help combat this situation is one of the reasons why the British implemented the colony of Georgia to be a buffer between Charleston and St. Augustine. In 1738, the Spanish counteracted, and they declared this town of Fort Mose, which is about a mile and a half north of St. Augustine. And this is where these freed slaves from the British colonies could come and they could live. It was the first free black settlement in what's now North America, and it remained as such. It was destroyed at one point in battles with the British, but came back to life later on in the 1750s, and then of course everything came crashing to an end in 1763 when Florida became British and slavery was universal.
Talk about Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Brown. You mentioned him earlier, but boy, he sounds like he was quite a guy.
Thomas Brown, my wife has a crush on him. Try and imagine a combination of Daniel Day-Lewis in The Last of the Mohicans and Errol Flynn in anything. Okay, that was Thomas Brown. He was the son of a fabulously wealthy shipping magnate in Whitby, England. He was the great grandson of Sir Isaac Newton. So he was well established in British society in every direction. He came over at the age of 24 landed in Savannah in September of 1774. He was 24 years old. He had 29 indentured servants and 5,600-acre land grant just north, about 30 miles north of Augusta, that had been given to him. And he came in, was going to establish a new community of Brownsboro, and he basically, when war broke out in April of 1775, he let it be known all up and down the Savannah River and everywhere that they could hear that he was a king's man. On August 2nd of 1775, and this story comes from approximately 10 to a dozen reports that have been cobbled together. But they are legitimate sources. About 100 Sons of Liberty from Augusta gathered on Brown's in his front yard and demanded that he sign an oath of loyalty to the rebellion or suffer the consequences. And he knew exactly what that meant. And he absolutely ripped into them. How dare you come to my home under the guise of independence and liberty and demand that I give up my own freedom of choice in the process? So approximately half of them felt bad and started to kind of filter away, and the other half started bickering with them. Brown slips into the house, grabs two pistols, and puts a sword on his side, comes out and fires off a shot, hits one guy, fires off another shot. His pistol misfires as he, and again, we're talking 100-1, literally.
Yeah.
He draws his sword. About that time, someone comes up from behind and fractures his skull with a rifle butt blow. They put him on a horse, lead him the 30 miles into Augusta, where he's stripped naked to his boots, beat savagely, then tied to a tree where, depending on the reports, he was scalped either 3 or 4 times. Then they tarred and feathered him. But they're not sure if either 2 or 3 toes burned off of his foot when it was either when the hot tar collected in his boots, or it was after that when they pulled his boots off and put hot brands to his feet. They then tossed him in the back of a cart and paraded him up and down the streets of Augusta. He survived.
And he came back to get his sort of revenge, didn't he?
He did. He came limping into St. Augustine in December of 1775. Governor Tonon had built a militia he called the East Florida Rangers, kind of a black ops group. And he had all these rugged backcountry woodsmen and creek warriors, but he didn't have an obvious leader. And here comes Thomas Brown. He's an aristocrat. The men look up to him, and needless to say, he's in a bad mood. And Tonon says, "That's my guy." And he put him in charge of the East Florida Rangers. And all of these stories we hear about Bannister Tarleton, and we see the depiction of him in the movie The Patriot. Bannister Tarleton committed a horrendous act at one battle, the Battle of Waxhaws, and he's lived in infamy ever since. Thomas Brown was the real deal. He was the one that if you were an American in favor of rebellion and you heard the bushes rustle outside your window at night, that's who you hoped would not be standing on your doorstep. And he was to be feared. And ended up being a tremendous asset to the British throughout the war.
So we are the Americans, the Revolutionary Forces, tried to invade East Florida, never could quite make it. So how did this all wrap up?
It wrapped up for the British citizens and subject here. It was ugly because they literally had repelled invasion attempts into the colony. They had been part of the invasions into Georgia and up into Charleston. And when the Treaty of Paris, when news of peace was circulating, they believed that they had won the right, just like the Canadians had, to, you know, maintain being a British loyal colony there in North America. What happened, though, was the British showed up to the 1783 Treaty of Paris, and Spain got greedy. They said, "We want Gibraltar," because the British owned the fortress there at Gibraltar, which means that they controlled everything coming and going out of the Mediterranean. And the British said, "You know, you guys tried twice during this last war to take Gibraltar. You failed. We'll fight again for that one." So the Spanish settled. the British... British being British, they said, "I'll tell you what, you captured West Florida in 1781, we'll let you keep it. And in the meantime, we'll also throw in East Florida so you can have Spanish Florida back." And that's what the Spanish settled for. So to say the least, the people here felt absolutely gutted. They realized they were nothing more than pawns in this geopolitical situation, and a lot of people instantly lost loyalty for king and country.
And Governor Tonon, is that how you pronounce his name?
He
was the last one to leave North America?
Yes, we always hear, and I can't tell you the number of historians who write about, the last British loyalist left New York Harbor on November 25th of 1783, when in fact Governor Tonan was mandated by the king, excuse me, you're to be the last subject out of the colony, and as long as there are British subjects in the colony, they're in your charge. And he didn't evacuate until November 13th of 1785, and that was 4 years after Yorktown, 2 years after the Treaty of Paris. These people believed up until that point that maybe, just maybe, even though the Spanish had been instituted here in East Florida in June and July of 1784, Tonan and his people weren't completely out until over a year later.
Hmm. How often, now we've just got a couple minutes left, how often do you go to the fort there in St. Augustine? And do you think it's a different experience for somebody who is immersed in history as you are? Because I've been there twice, and just reading this and remembering my visit there kind of gave it a whole different feeling.
It does. And when, as a tourist, I think when you go into the fort, you look around and go, oh, okay, this is neat, you know. And you hear the story about the cocaine, and you go feel it, and it's like, oh, yeah, I get it, and that's kind of neat. If you're into history, then you're looking back and you're going, wow, this thing was completed in 1695. I'm touching the same walls as people who lived during, you know, Spanish times, during the American Revolution, during World War One. I mean, you know, people who occupied the fort, the Apache, who were sent out here from Arizona when they were captured in the 1870s. You know, you're living, you're walking through the areas where they lived. They now have this wonderful display where they've taken etchings that different soldiers or prisoners and people like that have carved into the walls of the barracks and in different rooms, and they put panels over them so that you can see them more clearly. And the stories that these etchings tell, it just really brings it to life and brings it home how many people and how vast histories, how many vast histories have gone through here. It's just one of those places, like I said, I'm a little stumped for words right now, because the Castillo is just a very special place, and it's hard to try and put it all into a couple of minutes, you know.
Yep. Well, that is all the time we have for this part of the show. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Roger Smith, is author of the book, The 14th Colony, The American Revolution's Best Kept Secret. He joins us from St. Augustine. Dr. Smith, thanks so much for your time and insights into this fascinating piece of Florida history.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it so much.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, but when we return, we're talking trees with a Naples arborist as we plunge into rainy season. I'm Mike Canary. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. Stay with us.